Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about the politics of ancient Rome and perhaps drawing some comparisons between that time and our time. And we'll be doing that by looking at the life of Marcus Cicero, who may well have been the world's first professional politician. At least that's the argument of our guest this morning, Robert Harris. Most of the other Roman leaders of his time were aristocrats, and saw politics and participation in politics as an obligation that went with being an aristocrat. Cicero, however, was different. He was not highborn. He didn't have a great fortune and did not have a powerful social network behind him. What he has, however, says Robert Harris, is extraordinary drive and will. And you can see that in the novel that we'll be talking about here this morning. The novel is titled Imperium, a novel of ancient Rome. It's published by Simon & Schuster. The book came out in September, and it's the first of what is projected to be a series of three novels about the life of Cicero. This first one starts with some of his early years, talks about a political case, a legal case, something of both, political and legal case, that he was involved in that helped make his reputation. And then this book takes him up to the point where he becomes consul, and he is 42. And at that point, he has another 21 years to live, so a lot more history to come, a lot more of his life, and that story will be told in the books to come by our guest, Robert Harris. He's a former political journalist. He was a television correspondent with the BBC. He was a newspaper columnist for the London Sunday Times and the Daily Telegraph, and is the author of several other best-selling novels. Most of them set in the 20th century. However, a previous book, Pompeii, tells the story of the eruption of Pompeii. So that was perhaps his first dipping his toe into the waters of the ancient world. And now this book has followed. And it's a very entertaining read. We're talking this morning with Robert Harris. He's joining us by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Harris, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thank you for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
I certainly enjoyed the book. I did also enjoy Pompeii as well. It's a little bit different kind of story, but I like them both very much, and I would recommend them to people. They're both very entertaining.
Oh, great. Thank you. And I enjoyed writing them.
Well, and I think the thing, as I started reading Imperium, I think one of the things that I liked so much about it was not only the character of Cicero, but the fact that he says so many wonderful things about politics and politicians that, to me, certainly ring true. And what you have done is, as I understand it, not only much of what Cicero says in Imperium Cicero actually did say, because there's a great record of what he said. But you've also borrowed things here and there from other noted politicals over time and have given their words to Cicero as well. So it's on an almost an encyclopedic kind of collection of great quotes about politics.
Well, yes, I was a sort of nerd as a kind of for. As a teenager, I was very interested in politics when more normal contemporaries were interested in football. I was very interested in politics, British politics, American politics, any politics, actually. I've even been known on certain sad occasions to be interested in an Indian general election. And so over the years, I've accumulated a lot of information about politics and stories, and I've always wondered how to use it in fictional form. And I didn't really, although I'm a political journalist by background, I didn't really want to write a kind of modern political novel, simply because, well, for two reasons. One is you get bogged down, and people wonder, they think it's a Roman clay and are looking for the original models of your characters. And secondly, I never thought I could improve on the bizarreness of our actual rulers. And then when I finished Pompeii, which I enjoyed writing greatly, it occurred to me that perhaps I could write a novel about politics, a kind of universal novel about politics set in the last 20 or so years of the Roman Republic. And that is what I set out to do. And so the book is, I hope, both an accurate description of the Roman political system and the battles that went on, but also sheds light on our own times politically.
Mm-hmm. Well, even though you've located it in the past, and I'm sure that you would say to people reading, they'd say, well, the characters that appear in the book are all real people. They are who they are. I know that I read some comments, some wag said, well, this is New Labour in togas. And so that they want to see Tony Blair in Cicero, or maybe here on our side, we would see Bill Clinton in Cicero.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think you might be prepared to argue, well, you can perhaps draw some comparisons between men like Clinton and Tony Blair and Marcus Cicero.
Yes, to this extent, Cicero was a professional politician and a performer and a lawyer. He reveled in human contact and in speaking and in persuading. He enjoyed politics, and his operation as a lawyer through to politics was seamless. He didn't go into politics for any particular cause. He went in it because it was a glorious thing to do. And because, as you pointed out in your introduction, he didn't have an army behind him, he didn't have great wealth, at least to begin with, he didn't have an aristocratic family, he had to shift with public opinion. He had to appeal to the thousands of voters in Rome. In 54 BC, I came across a letter that he wrote to a friend that he said, consistency has never been regarded as a virtue in a great statesman. Our language changes, but our aim remains the same. And that certainly sounds like Tony Blair in my country, and I suspect sounds a little like Bill Clinton in yours.
Mm-hmm. The literary conceit of the book is that this is a biography of Cicero being written by a man who was his secretary, who was actually a slave, although apparently the men were really rather close, and he was freed after Cicero died. This was Marcus Tiro, who also was a real person. He indeed was the secretary of Cicero, and perhaps we owe it to him that we have so many of Cicero's words now.
Yes, Cicero employed this man, Tiro, who was born on a family estate. He was a couple of years younger than Cicero, and they kind of, from the late 20s onwards, they seem to have been pretty well inseparable. His brilliant contribution, actually, was to invent shorthand. He seems to have been the inventor of stenography to keep pace with the flow of words that Cicero poured out, constantly writing letters, dictating speeches. Tiro was the first man to take down a speech in the Senate verbatim, and we still have that speech. And this system of shorthand that he developed existed for centuries after his death. And it seemed, and also he lived, according to Saint Jerome, to be 100 years old, and wrote a multi-volume Life of Cicero. So it seemed to me he was almost a gift to a novelist, perfect to recollect in old age. He outlived Cicero by 30 years or more. To have him recollect in old age what he had seen as he worked at the side of his boss. And this gave me a way into my material. If you imagine the chief of staff of a president or the press secretary of a prime minister writing their memoirs many years later when it's safe for them to do so and telling all the stories behind the scenes, that is what I've tried to do. To use a kind of crude term, I've tried to write a kind of West Wing on the Tiber, politics behind the scenes as it was practiced in the first century before Christ.
Mm. And apparently, or at least we are told by Plutarch and others, that Tiro actually did write a biography of Cicero, but at some point down through the years it was lost, so we actually don't have the real thing.
Yeah, it was. Plutarch refers to it, another ancient historian called Asconius refers to it. But it was lost sometime around the 4th or 5th century AD, and I doubt whether we'll ever recover it. It could be slightly embarrassing to me if we ever do, but I don't think we're likely to. It would have been, according to scholars, quite a gossipy account in any case, and it's from Tiro, who was at Cicero's side, that Plutarch drew a lot of the material that he put in his own brief biographical picture of Cicero, and the details of Cicero's death, for instance. And Cicero himself wrote to Tiro, that we have a letter that he wrote saying, you know, you were by my side in all my affairs, public and private, at home and abroad. There was nothing that Tiro didn't know. So he's a perfect device, really, for me. I can observe Cicero, who was a genius, from the outside. I don't think it would be possible for a modern novelist very easily to get inside the mind of a genius like Cicero, but my slave secretary can observe him day by day, and the two of them enter the kind of jungle, the treacherous jungle of Roman politics and the legal and the courts, the battles in the courts. And the moment I found this character and this way of writing the novel, it went very quickly. I've never written a book so quickly, nor have I enjoyed a book so much.
How are we? How are you doing on the second installment on the series?
Well, that is underway, and I hope to have it out next year or the year after. My aim is that each of these three novels will be self-contained. You don't have to read all three of them, or you don't have to read them in sequence. This one carries Cicero from his struggles as a young lawyer, a radical kind of district attorney, you could almost say, bringing down a corrupt Roman governor, to his challenge for the supreme office in the Roman system, consul. And it's his battles and his shifting alliances and his home life and all those kinds of things. So this ends in 63 BC. The next one will cover Cicero in power and then his exile, and the final one will cover the final 10 years or so of the Roman Republic, which is that's the period that's more familiar to the people. That's, for instance, the period that's in the HBO Rome series.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Robert Harris. He is the author of Imperium, a novel of ancient Rome. It is the story of Roman politics and also of the life of Marcus Cicero. And as we have mentioned, this is the first of what's projected to be a series of three books that cover the life of Cicero. This first one just came out in September. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore or the library. Questions here are welcome. Of course, people want to join in the conversation. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Cicero was thrilled with politics. He looked at it as being, I think, something of a game in a sense. He certainly was interested in establishing his reputation and in acquiring some political power and influence. I mentioned that we're fortunate that we have so many of Cicero's words still. And in the book, you quote him, and apparently this is something that Cicero actually said. Someone said observed that they thought that politics was boring. And Cicero said, "Politics? Boring? Politics is history on the wing. You might as well say that life itself is boring." Well, Cicero actually said that. So obviously it was a reflection of his excitement with politics. You said a moment ago that it's difficult to get inside his head, but do you have some sense of what it was that produced this man and gave him this kind of drive and gave him this kind of enthusiasm to take to politics, not because he felt obligated or it was something that came with his birth, but it was just something that he felt driven to do? Was it, in fact, something about recognition, do you think, public recognition?
I think so, yes. He was hungry for fame and for glory. He was not equipped by nature, really, to be a soldier. In his early years, he's supposed to have been rather feeble physically and highly strung, although he conquered that by a strict regime of exercises. He did the bare minimum of military service, something else you might find familiar with modern politicians, and then got out as soon as he could. And became a lawyer. Even there, he was a self-made man in a way, because although he was probably the greatest speaker of his age and maybe one of the greatest speakers of all time, he had to learn the tricks of rhetoric. And I open the novel with him with a true story, which is that he went and was taught how to speak by a tutor of rhetoric called Apollonius Molon, who had a school of rhetoric on the island of Rhodes in the eastern Mediterranean. And Mollon taught not only Cicero, but also Julius Caesar, the tricks of oratory. How to command an audience of 3,000 or 4,000 or more in the open air, or 600 men in the Senate, and to speak without notes for 2 hours. I mean, how did one do that? That was one of the things that intrigued me about that political system. For Cicero, the law courts and politics were the battlefield where glory could be won. Where this hunger for fame came from, who knows, and who knows where it comes from anyone. He seems to have been slightly starved of affection by his mother, certainly he was extremely clever. Why he was driven in this way is, of course, something we'll never know. Why is anyone driven into politics? But in those days, politics was the natural arena for anyone who wanted to have dignity and authority. It was as natural as breathing. If you wanted to be eminent, you went into politics.
Mm-hmm. You talked about his talent, his power as a speaker, about how he studied with his famous Greek teacher of rhetoric and came back and used that to great effectiveness in the Senate and also speaking to the people. And you have to imagine this either in the Senate where there were hundreds of members or out in the open where he might be talking to thousands of people. Here he is, one man. We're not talking about any amplification here, so he can't take advantage of that. And somehow he has to manage to talk with these people, hold their attention. And Cicero, by all accounts, could do that, could literally keep the people in the proverbial palm of his hand. How did one do that? And as you say, talk as he could, give a speech of a couple of hours without notes, with no microphone, and be able to be as successful at it, as apparently good at it, as he was.
Well, it's a fantastically interesting question, I think. I just finished reading that wonderful book about Lincoln, Team of Rivals. I mean, Lincoln would be speaking in the 19th century to audiences of 15 or 20,000 without amplification. Gladstone, the Prime Minister in Britain at the same time, was speaking to audiences of 25,000 at the end of the 19th century. There seems to have been some system whereby the words were relayed by a kind of sign language or passed on by people at intervals spaced out in the crowd to those at the back. But, I mean, Cicero may well have addressed audiences of more than 10,000. You were not supposed to use notes because you were supposed to look as if you were speaking from the heart, and you had certain dramatic gestures that you used. The natural range of the human voice, I believe, is 80 yards. That's as many people as could be crammed around. Cicero memorized speeches, as did most of his compatriots, by a system of an imaginary journey around a room. If you imagine the opening of your speech, you imagine that in your mind as being you're walking through the front door of your house, and then the second point, the second passage in your speech, you imagine as sort of going through the hall. The third passage is the stairs, and so on. And in this way, this was the mnemonic system by which you could call to mind what you were going to say. And bearing in mind, you might be speaking for 2 hours. These were amazing productions. But, you know, politics then, as now, was theater. Cicero was the best show in town, and it was free. You know, you went down to the Forum to hear Cicero as you might go and see a great actor or a great musician.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Robert Harris. He is a former political journalist turned novelist. He has written several, and they have all done very well, sold very well. His books include Pompeii, Enigma, and Fatherland, some of them set in the 20th century. Pompeii set around the eruption of the volcano, and he has just recently published in September a new novel, the first in a series of three, that look at ancient Roman politics through the eyes of Marcus Cicero. The first book, Imperium, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And the next one, I think, is expected maybe sometime next year.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I hope so, if I can get down to write it.
If people like me don't stop bothering you.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure to talk about it, actually. And it's nice to be able to do so at some length. Normally you have to condense what you have to say into about 45 seconds.
Oh. Well, we're very pleased that you could be talking with us. Robert Harris is the guest. And questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps you would talk a little bit about this case that he prosecuted against a former Roman governor of Sicily, a man named Verres. This was the thing that really helped establish Cicero's reputation. He was a man that, by all accounts, when he was the governor of Sicily, managed to steal everything that was not nailed down. And anybody who got in his way, his way of dealing with them basically was to have them murdered, and managed to loot the place and then leave. He was also someone who had a lot of powerful connections in Rome. And you would think that things here did not look favorable for Cicero and his prosecution, given the fact that he was not all that well known, but Verres was powerful, had powerful friends. He was represented by the man who at the time was considered to be the greatest lawyer in Rome. And I hope I'm not giving away too much by saying that Cicero won the case. Perhaps you could just sketch out the basics of this case and why it was that Cicero decided to take this on in the first place.
Well, normally, Cicero, in fact, I think this is the only prosecution he ever mounted. Cicero specialized in defense, and he would defend a lot. He would probably defend in the law courts three or four times a week when they were in session. And the idea was that you couldn't accept payment, but people would vote for you if you got them off. And Cicero was the great defense lawyer in Rome. And in his 30s, he went out as a magistrate for a year to Sicily just to dispense justice. You had to do that for a year before you could take your seat in the Senate. So he made some contacts in Sicily, continued defending, and then this man Verres went for 3 years as governor in Sicily and, as you say, completely pillaged the place. And a deputation of Sicilians approached Cicero and asked if he would prosecute Verres when he lost his immunity and returned to Rome. And Cicero, after some deliberation, decided to take this case, even though it was enormously risky. I think because, well, for two reasons, really. One is that it enabled him to become extremely popular. It was a popular cause to prosecute Verres. And Cicero had his eye on the next round of elections. And also because by defeating Verres, he could defeat, as you say, this man Hortensius, who was Verres's lawyer, who was at that time regarded as the premier lawyer in Rome. So Cicero could vault into first position and become very popular. And he took this immense gamble. He had to go to Sicily in very dangerous circumstances, in the dead of winter, when the place was still full of Verres' spies and agents, and he had to collect evidence. He only had 2 months in which to do it. And then he came back to Rome and faced a series of procedural ambushes in the court, but brilliantly managed to turn this around and triumphed, and Verres was sent into exile. And this... The story of this, which really is as good a real-life crime trial as you'll get in John Grisham, actually. That's not boasting. That's the actual fact of the case, which I tell. This was the making of Cicero. And this struck me as incredibly modern. This was like an ambitious district attorney bringing down the corrupt politician, thereby being able to run for office. And it's a great story. And Cicero's brilliant speech, Civis Romanus Sum, I am a Roman citizen, with which he finally skewered Verres on the witness stand, is a masterpiece of oratory, and I just put a page or so of it in the novel. And I think even now, even after 2,000 years, it can raise the hairs on the back of your head as a fantastic piece of invective, smashing away at this... the defendant, and finally finishing him off.
Yeah, one of the things you write about in the book is how it is his opponents tried to maneuver things in a sense to back him into a corner so that he would not have the amount of time to present his case that he would have expected. It would have been, who knows how long it would be that you would get to speak and you would get to lay out the charges, and that what happened was that he didn't have as much time as he would have expected to have. And in fact, he apparently turned that to his advantage, because he said, all right, fine, I've only got this much time, this is what I'm going to do, and gave this very powerful speech, which we still have. You can go out and read it, because it was all written down. And that perhaps that worked better for him than if things had gone the way that you would expect it. That is, the way the trials at the time were carried out.
Yes, I mean, it was a brilliant coup de théâtre, really. He had the corruption trials of this sort took place in the Forum in front of the Temple of Castor, and in this case it was scheduled for August in the burning heat of Rome in August, and there were tens of thousands of people in town, both for the annual elections in which Cicero was standing and also for a huge celebratory games being given by Pompey the Great, the ruler of Rome at that time. And what Cicero did was amass literally scores, dozens of witnesses and huge hundreds, thousands of documents were carried into court in front of the watching multitudes. And it was like it was an amazing public spectacle that he laid on. And it's this theatrical quality of Cicero's which, you know, I find very interesting, and also it's so modern. And the notion of this man learning how to speak with a voice coach and then bringing these skills to bear and using the law courts as a platform to become famous and challenge for office, it's so modern. It's extraordinary. And for me, the pleasure of writing about this period is that it universalizes politics. Well, you know, this is how politics is in your system and my system and in any system. This is how ambition plays out. Mm. And the fact that the Roman system was so similar, in particular, to the American system, because the founding fathers borrowed so much of the structure of American politics from ancient Rome, makes it feel extraordinarily fresh, I think. This is the Rome of the Republic, not the Rome of the emperors, which is what most people think of when they think of Rome.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let us do that. We'll start with someone in Champaign and line number one. Hello.
Hi. Just wanted to make a comment. Many years ago, when I was in high school, I took 4 years of Latin. And at that time, the study of Latin consisted of Caesar, Cicero, and Virgil. And I was very distraught to find out that nowadays these great writers and thinkers are saved for college and not for the high school students studying Latin. Cicero had such an effect on me, such great orations that we translated, and my teacher would take the time to actually say to us so we could hear the cadence and the thoughts that he had, and the whole notion of virtu, which really has no good translation in English, to the point that when I was finally able to visit Rome and stood in the Forum, the feeling that I was standing where Cicero gave his orations was just so overwhelming. This man was brilliant, and I really am so grateful to you for writing your novel to bring him back to people who obviously aren't going to even get him in Latin classes anymore.
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. And part of what I wanted to do was to bring Cicero back, because he's been overshadowed completely by Julius Caesar. I think Shakespeare takes a lot of the blame for this. But in many ways, Cicero was a much more interesting character than Caesar. And the two were, as you know, rivals and friends all their lives. And Cicero was not only this man of action, he was also, as you say, a compassionate man, and a man who detested cruelty, even the cruelty to animals in the games. He's a very modern and accessible figure, I think. And it is a great shame that the study of this time is one of the first things that seems to be cut in schools when they face problems with funding. It's difficult to keep this flame alive, but it's important that we do, because it's a link between our time and the foundations of our civilization. And to be able to read Cicero as all the great thinkers have done over the past 2,000 years, is a wonderful experience.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really enjoying this conversation.
All right.
Well
thank you.
For joining in.
Let's talk with someone on the campus, and this will be someone next on line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I share the previous caller's enthusiasm for this author's works. I would like to ask him if he feels the series Rome on HBO, number one, represented the period effectively, and number two, represented Cicero at all well. I think this has inspired an interest in this period for a number of Americans, including myself. That's the end of my question.
Yep. All right. Mr. Harris?
Well, I mean, I'm in the unfortunate position of having done too much work on this period and have turned myself into an old pedant. And therefore, I don't think it gives a very fair or accurate portrayal of Cicero, and I have difficulties with other aspects of it, in particular the rather raunchy female character, Attia, the mother of the future emperor, who is played like something out of a Bob Guccione movie, whereas, in fact, the real-life Attia, according to Tacitus, was, and I quote, the strictest and sternest of Roman matrons in whose presence no wrong word could be uttered. somewhat different to the character you see on screen. But still, I mean, as I say, this is probably because I've just sort of immersed myself too much in the period, and I think that anything that gets people fired up about the ancient world is great. I mean, I think Ridley Scott's movie Gladiator, and I know some academics are critical of it, nevertheless, it did an enormous amount to rekindle, especially among boys of, you know, 14, 15, right. A difficult age, you know, for boys interested in history. It transformed, I think, the way we think about the ancient world and its popularity. And I think that's important. Everything that we all do, we popularize as depends upon the scholars who've done the work beforehand. But nevertheless, I think it's important in this day and age that the names of people like Cicero, that they're brought to a mass audience's attention through the movies and through books. And, you know, I'm pleased to be able to try and do a bit to help on that, because studying Rome, which I've done now for the past 6 years, first writing Pompeii and then writing this, has enriched my life hugely, without wishing to sound too pious about it. It makes one realize that the problems that we face, our modern world, the similar problems were faced 2,000 years ago. People were fundamentally the same 2,000 years ago. Cicero dropped today in Washington would be perfectly at home, just as the love poetry of Catullus is all about the agonies and ecstasies of love, recognized by anyone who reads it now as it would have been 2,000 years ago. And I think this link between us nowadays and the past is vitally important that we maintain it and nurture it.
Well, thank you. I look forward to reading this series.
Right. Thank you.
Goodbye. Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. Let me introduce again our guest, Robert Harris. He is the author of a recently published novel, Imperium, a novel of ancient Rome. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It is the first of what's projected to be a series of three novels that look at the politics of ancient Rome, looking through the eyes and through the experiences of Marcus Cicero. This first book takes us up to the point where Cicero is 42, where he becomes consul, and there are another 21 years of life ahead of Cicero, so there will be two more books. Robert Harris has authored also the novels Pompeii, Enigma, and Fatherland. He was a correspondent for the BBC, also has been newspaper columnist for the London Sunday Times and the Daily Telegraph, and his novels have sold very well, millions of copies literally, and have been translated into a number of languages. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in just maybe hearing you talk a little bit about the experience of writing the writing Pompeii and then writing this, in the sense that with Pompeii, while you were writing about actual events, your characters were your creations. Here with Imperium, all of the people that appear in the book, Cicero and his wife and brother and associates, and all of the other Pompey and Caesar and Crassus and all of these other people who appear in the book, were all actually real people. And in the case of Cicero, we actually have a lot of things. We know what Cicero said because they were written down and we still have them. So that, in a sense, constrains you a little bit. Because you're dealing with real people and their actual words. Does that, how would you compare those two experiences and the kind of either, you know, freedom on the one hand that you would have as a writer and perhaps some constraints on the other with each of the two stories?
Yes, well, it has been very interesting to do this novel because it's, I mean, what have we got of Cicero's? We've got more than 800 letters that he wrote. We have 56 full-length speeches, and we have 14 books. That's an astonishing amount of material from a figure who died more than 2,000 years ago. And so there are patches of this story that are incredibly well-known and where we know what Cicero was doing almost hourly. Then there are other areas of it which are completely lost to us and we don't understand. And I felt, as I was writing the book each day, like someone perhaps who was restoring a picture, or perhaps even better, a mosaic, that there would be areas where all the tiles were still in place and were vividly colored. And then there'd be great patches of brown earth where everything had gone, and one just had to sort of sketch the lines and then put in the tiles afresh. It was a very rewarding and enjoyable experience to do it every day because I felt I was on a process of discovery, that I would write, suddenly feel, oh, that's what it must have been like, that's what that character must have been like, that is what that must have happened. So it was a process of almost a reconstruction, of imaginative reconstruction. Pompeii was, as you say, completely my own story. And although I did quite a lot of research, the central character is an engineer in it, and I did a lot of research on what actually happened to Pompeii. Nevertheless, I was doing all that myself, and it was a very stimulating book to write. But I think I enjoyed writing Imperium more. I suppose any novelist wants to feel that what they're writing is true, whether it's imaginative or not, and I just got a terrific buzz thinking that it must have been something like this and that no one really had tried to do this before. Imagine a debate in the Senate or the details of the Roman electoral system. What was election day like in Rome with 20 or 30,000 people voting? You know, that sort of thing was wonderfully enjoyable to try and imagine.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about how people in reading the book will want to try to draw parallels between the characters here and people in contemporary politics, and that there may in fact be parallels to be drawn. I wanted to have you talk a little bit about the relationship between Cicero and his wife, since nowadays we make a lot of relationship between politicians and their wives and how important they can be. And again, I suppose that makes you think about Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. We talked about the fact that Cicero was not a member. He was not born to the aristocracy. He was not born wealthy. But he did have connections through his wife. She had money. It was a marriage that seems in some ways to have been a marriage of convenience, a political marriage. You wonder about just how they might have felt about each other, at least at the beginning. Although, as you tell the story, she was an important supporter, in a sense, someone that he could bounce off ideas off of, someone perhaps when he was going too far, when he was making a mistake. She would have been one of the people who would have said to him those things. Terentia, tell us about her.
Well, she is an interesting character, and I must say I enjoyed writing about her. She was a bit younger than Cicero. She was aristocratic. Her half-sister was a Vestal Virgin, which was a sign of aristocratic importance. She was, according to Plutarch, who may well have got this from Tiro's lost book, very much a strong character, like to play her part and say her views, and not at all given to simply sitting in the corner and doing the sewing with the children. I think that she was rather more conservative than her husband. I suspect that she would have found his populist platforms distasteful. I think she gave him a hard time quite often. He certainly married her, I think, partly for the connections and partly because she had a lot of money. You needed to be a millionaire to be a senator. You needed to actually show the authorities that you had a million in the bank. And it was only really by marrying Terentia that Cicero could do that. But women in those days, oddly enough, could keep quite a lot of control over their own money and were powerful figures behind the scenes. And I don't think he was able to do much without consulting her first. And I think that they, in my book, they sort of bicker and row, but gradually their relationship becomes stronger. And I think she became ambitious through him. And I do think that it does remind one of those kind of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt or Bill and Hillary Clinton. One does feel it's one of those political marriages which has worked because each of them is as interested in public life as the other. And I enjoyed writing that. It's not at all a conventional sort of love story, but there's something oddly satisfying about it even so. She seems to have had some difficulty getting pregnant, but eventually he had a son and a daughter by her. And one of the more attractive things about Cicero was he was an absolutely devoted father, and his daughter was probably the person in the world he loved the most. And this domestic life of the senior politician is something it was very enjoyable to write about. The way in which one used one's private life to show oneself to be a kind of upright citizen. People were always trooping through your house if you were a politician, and you were always on display. And so the two sides of life wove together, and all of it took place within this limited geographical area of Rome, and everybody lived within a few hundred yards of one another, even your deadliest rival. So Rome is just this enormous swirling melting pot of ambition and intrigue and love and dislike, all going on. And I would say that those 20 years, the last 20 years or so of the Roman Republic, are among the most interesting they've ever been in the history of humanity.
Well, and perhaps one of the reasons that the story is appealing and engaging is, and another one of the ways that perhaps it resonates with us is that we seem to be in a time when drawing the line between people's public lives and their private lives is very difficult. And in this particular case, it would seem that it would be very difficult to have much of a private life because one's public life would continually be intruding in a very literal sort of way, as you have described it.
Yes, and you had to have, to be a Roman statesman really and taken seriously, you had to have the two things they called dignity and authority. They were vital, and this Rome that I write about is far closer to the sort of Victorian era in terms of morality and putting on a good face. And not at all like the decadent Rome of the emperors, when all these extraordinary orgies and unbelievable public spectacles were held. This was, not just like Victorian times, but probably like our own time, as you say, did in private was important and had an impact on your public career. And I've tried to reflect that in the book. And Cicero is a great one for glad-handing and kissing babies and pressing the flesh and all this sort of thing that we associate with modern politics. This is what Cicero had to do every morning when he went down into the forum. Remember everyone's name. Have a word for everyone. It's the similarities to modern politics, I don't want to push them too hard, but they are there, and they are, once you start to examine them, overwhelming.
Our guest, Robert Harris, his new novel is Imperium, about ancient Rome and the life of Cicero, the first of three. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in the program. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Would that, you're talking about his way with people, his person-to-person kind of talent, which is something now, even now, certainly is something that's very powerful in politics. And we see that there are some people who are really good at that and others that are not. Would it have been more likely that Cicero would have done that and less likely that more highborn politicians would have done that? Would they have waded into the crowd, in a sense, the way that Cicero did?
No, I don't think so. I think that Cicero was much more of a populist and had to make his own way. They were known in Rome rather sneeringly by the nobility as new men. Cicero was a new man. That was that no ancestor of his had ever been a magistrate, a senior magistrate. And so they indulged in what the Roman nobles called new man's business, which was essentially building up a following of clients at the law courts and putting yourself around at election time. Our word ambition actually comes from the Roman ambitius, which was to walk around. And for the 2 or 3 weeks of the official election campaign every summer, that was what you did. You walked around, you met the voters, you asked after their wives, you remembered all their names and their business, you did little favors for them, you appeared in the law courts, you looked after them, and in return they voted for you. This was what Cicero had to do. His aristocratic opponents did not have to do this nearly as much. They already had thousands of people who were indirectly employed by them, dependent upon them, had voted for their fathers and grandfathers, and they had these great names like Crassus or Catullus or Hortensius. They were already famous. I mean, the firstborn son took exactly the same name as his father, and was considered to be the kind of reincarnation of his father. Rather, I suppose, like the Bushes, now I come to think of it.
Well, I've perished the thought that you would still have to be a millionaire to be in the Senate, but that's yet another sort of parallel. We're almost to the point we have to finish. I hope you would forgive me for asking about something a little bit different, but I'm just very curious, since you were someone who had been a political reporter and had spent a lot of time early on in his rise to power following Tony Blair. And I'm just interested in having you talk a little bit about now whither Tony Blair, now that he has come to the point where he rose to a great height and now seems to have fallen. At least he's now been, by his own party, has been forced out. And he said that, yes, he's definitely going to go. And that apparently a lot of that had to do with his support for George Bush and for the American war in Iraq. What's going to happen with Tony Blair?
Well, he will go. He will certainly be gone by next summer. And he may even, because the only bit of initiative he has left really now is to go when people aren't expecting it, he could announce quite soon and take everyone by surprise. The British politician Enoch Powell had a great quote. He said that all political lives must end in failure because such is the nature of politics and of human affairs. Unless a politician is assassinated or dies young in office, most political careers end in failure. And sadly, Blair seems to be doing the same. And there's no doubt that hung around his neck is the war in Iraq, which has done him enormous damage. It was an unpopular war, more unpopular in Britain than it was in America. And there's been a sense that he has been too eager to trot along behind George Bush. And so all that he can do now is he'll be spending a lot of time in America, I think, from now on, lecturing, writing his memoirs. You may see more of him over there than we see over here.
Mm. Well, at least he won't suffer the same fate as Cicero. They won't display his head and hands in Trafalgar Square anytime soon, probably.
Well, I certainly hope not. I mean, at least there is that difference. Politics is a little bit more now.
Yeah. Now you you're working on the second book here, and then there will be a third book. So at least you know what you'll be doing here in a couple of years. Are there any other projects that you have in mind? Things that you would like to write about? Maybe not fully formed ideas, but if I said, well, once you're finished with Cicero and finished at least with this story, do you have some sort of idea about what you would like to do next?
Yes, well, I do. I do have. There's one particular project, a political novel, a contemporary one, which I've had in mind for years and years, 14 or 15 years, and I think the moment may have come to do it. And I may even slip that in first before I write volume two of the trilogy, simply because I quite like to write it. I'd also quite like to do something about making a film of Pompeii, if I can. It's not the film rights, there were small offers, but nothing really came of it. But I feel that it would make a great film, and I would quite like to write the script of that myself. So if I can get some time, I would like to do that and see whether I could get anywhere with that as a project. So that, and I have four children, all of school age, so my life is fairly busy one way and another.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, it's been a pleasure, David. Thank you very much, and I hope to speak to you again sometime.
Well, indeed so. Robert Harris, our guest, his novel is Imperium, the novel of ancient Rome. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You might also look at his others, including Pompeii, Enigma, and Fatherland. I'm sure you could find them all in the bookstores. He's been a television correspondent with the BBC, also a newspaper columnist for the London Sunday Times and the Daily Telegraph.